This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross.
The Dick Van Dyke Show, starring Dick Van Dyke. Rosemary.
If you think there's a golden age of American television, chances are pretty good that my guest John Rich had a hand in some of the shows you love. Rich spent more than 50 years directing, writing, and producing TV shows, including The Dick Van Dyke Show, All in the Family, Gunsmoke, The Twilight Zone, Gilligan's Island, The Brady Bunch, MacGyver, and Murphy Brown. He won 3 Emmys and 3 Golden Globe Awards, and he also directed 5 feature films in the 1960s. Let's get a taste of his work. Here's a scene from The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Where's Rich?
Shouldn't he be eating?
He's already had breakfast.
What do you have?
Waffles and bacon.
How's come he gets all those good things and I always get scrambled eggs?
Well, gee, because when I ask you what you want for breakfast, you always say scrambled eggs.
Well, honey, that's because I'm half asleep. I got scrambled eggs memorized.
John Rich has written a book about his days with great actors and writers, temperamental stars, and cowardly studio executives. It's called Warm Up the Snake, a Hollywood memoir. After coming home from World War II, Rich did a stint in radio and was told that if he wanted to direct television, he'd have to first work as a stage manager. I asked him what he learned from his early days in TV.
Mostly I learned by watching bad directors what not to do. And I don't mean that facetiously. I learned, obviously, from good directors, but you learn more from watching a bad director because you would see how he would get himself into a scrape, and you could say, after a while, you'd begin to figure out, how would I do that a little bit better? And initially, in my mind, I was doing different ways of approaching the sequence, and I'd be wrong, of course, but then some wise head, a producer probably, or writer, would bail the director out, and I would say, aha, so that's what happened. The next time I would sharpen my instincts and I would say, I would do it this way. And I began to hit where I was right.
Can you think of an example of something you learned from bad directing?
Well, there was a director that was scathingly called Captain Video because he used to ask for silly things. For example, they were doing a remote once at the Brooklyn Navy Yard where the battleship New Jersey was tied up. And he said, looking through the camera lens, move the boat 4 feet to the left. Well, the boat was 45,000 tons of warship and was completely secured by hawsers. And somebody mildly suggested, why don't you move the camera right 4 inches or whatever it was? Oh, yeah, I'll do that. He had unique perspective on what could move and what couldn't move.
Well, you get into the business and of course, catch the wave of early television. And then in the early 60s, you had the great fortune to work on the Dick Van Dyke Show with that cast of
tremendous.
Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore and Rose Marie.
Yep. And Maury Amsterdam.
Right. You mentioned in the book that this was such a crackling good cast that you actually had to kind of control the timing of them early on. You found that if you weren't careful, they would kind of peak too early in the week, get too good before they were before the audience.
That absolutely happened on my first try. I had been doing one-camera film shows like Gunsmoke and Bonanza, shows that were out in the field. And there, when you do one camera, you get a 2 or 3 minute sequence, get it up to speed, and immediately put it in the can. You shoot a short section, and that's the way it was done. It was very efficacious to do that. I came on to the Van Dyke Company. It was a 3-camera film. And the company was so good that on my very first day, I found that I was employing the same method. I was getting them up, and they were just terrific. And by the end of the day, we had staged the entire piece. And the cast was euphoric. Everybody was saying, what a wonderful day, and it was. Driving home, I thought, it was a great day, and then suddenly it hit me. Oh, my God. I have just done what the coach of the professional team has done. I got the people up on Thursday for a show for a football game that doesn't play until Sunday. I've got this cast up on Wednesday, and we don't go on the air until Tuesday. It's going to be stale. And I said, oh, my goodness, it was stupid of me to do that. When I came in the next day, they were all raring to go. They said, the best day of rehearsal I'd ever had. I said, yeah, it was very good, but I have a couple of ideas. I called the prop department, the prop man over, and I said, please, rearrange. I told him quietly. I said, rearrange the set so that it's completely backwards, in a sense. And I took a break. We rearranged the set. I asked the actors to go through the motions, and they kept stumbling into things, and they say, what was wrong with yesterday? I said, well, it was good, but there may be something we can find better here. I forced them to fool around for an entire day, wrecked the day, actually. They were irate. Well, I shouldn't say irate, but they were puzzled mostly, but a little annoyed. And on the third day, on Friday, when I came in, I said, you know, you were all right. Let's put the set back the way it was on Wednesday. And then they performed beautifully. From then on, I said, I will never, ever get a company up that fast. You've got to do it incrementally, a little bit at a time, before you don't want it to peak too soon.
Well, let's talk about All in the Family, which was such a hit and something that a real breakthrough series on television. And it was interesting how this came to you. You had two great opportunities at once, and this looked like the weaker of the two, right, in some ways.
Oh, not just the weaker. It looked like, no, it was the stronger of the two, but in my view, it was the one least likely to succeed because of its language. The shows that you're referring to, on the same day, this is incredible, for a freelance director, I was offered the pilot for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Norman Lear had called with the pilot of All in the Family. I read both scripts. Mary's script was outstanding. It was funny and wonderful, but in the genre of really excellent situation comedy. But All in the Family had this language that I said, this is 1970. Nobody will allow this on American television. And it was so compelling to me because the writing was terrific. I called Mary and I said, look, I'm going to have to pass on your show, but I know it's going to be a big hit. But I've got to try this other thing as an experiment. Now, I don't think it's going to get on the air, mind you. And I think it'll be dead after the first couple of episodes, but I've got to try it. So if you will have me when this thing fails, I'll be delighted to come back and do some of the episodes of Mary Tyler Moore, gladly. But I have to pass right now. Well, I took the job on All the Family. It was a great risk because I thought this will never get on the air.
Well, it was so different. And one of the moments that I love in the book is where I guess you'd done the first 13 episodes, and it wasn't clear if the network was going to renew it, and then...
No, it was very clear. We were canceled.
The answer was no.
The answer was we're finished.
And then you're in Hawaii, and you meet this person. Tell that story.
Well, because we were canceled, and I was rather tired. I mean, after 13 weeks of live work, no editing, I took my family to the island of Kauai, and we were having lunch, and the waitress was a very nice Japanese lady, who was very apologetic. She said, do you mind if paying for the lunch right now? It was 2 o'clock and I have to leave early. I said, well, sure, but may I ask, what's so compelling on a Sunday afternoon that you want to get home? She said, it's television. There's a new show called All in the Family, and I've got to watch this. Well, I was amazed, but I didn't tell her my connection, but I said, what is it about the show that appeals to you so? And she said, that Archie Bunker, that's my husband. Well, I thought, holy mackerel, if a Japanese lady can make this adjustment, I'll bet you this is happening in other places because people are going to be... I had heard already from some people who had said, you know, that's my father. And in fact, it was Norman Lear's father and a good piece of my father, I hate to say, people who are trapped by old-fashioned notions. So sure enough, when I got back, apparently they had put the show on in reruns in the summer, and it began to catch on.
Well, you know, one of the more memorable episodes was where Sammy Davis Jr. ends up coming to visit Archie Bunker, who happens to be a black guy that Archie Bunker really likes.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
now,
yeah.
But you know, this is a film of working class people in Queens. Why did you decide to get Sammy Davis into a show?
Well, we didn't want to do it, frankly. Norman came to me one day and he said, Sammy Davis' agent... had said, when is Sammy going to be on? I said, what are you talking about? Well, apparently, in our opening weeks, Sammy had been on the Johnny Carson show and was talking about this new show, All in the Family, and praising it. And we thought, this is wonderful. We need the publicity. It's great. And so the agent called Norman and said, when is he going to be on the show? And Norman said, well, I don't think he's going to be. He came to me, said, what do you think about Sammy Davis on the... I said, no, just exactly what you just said. It's a middle-class Queens family. How do you put these two together? If anything, it would be not typecasting, but it would be celebrity casting, which we don't want to do because you can't have that kind of visitation. And the agent said, well, he can play any part. And we said, no. If he ever showed up, he'd have to be himself. He's too big a star. And he kept going and going. And Sammy kept talking about, I'm going to be on the show. And one day Norman came and said, you know, the pressure is on. Maybe we can do one episode. I said, well, you're going to have to lay down an awful lot of pipe, which a phrase we use for exposition, to explain how it's even possible. So cleverly, Norman began
meaning
to write...
set up a plot so that he gets there
set
and it's
up
believable.
Plot line, but it had to have been done carefully some 6 or 7 weeks earlier. So Norman came up with the idea of having Bunker occasionally drive, moonlighting a cab, Munson's cab. He would drive this taxi, which would allow Sammy Davis to get into the cab one night, leave a briefcase, and with that conceit, we would say, Archie would find the briefcase, and because he had given Sammy his address and his phone number, because he wanted a picture, and the briefcase was left in the cab, and Archie had it. The phone rings, and it's Sammy saying, you've got my briefcase. And Bunker says, oh, yeah, it's over at the cab office, but I can get it for you. He said, well, if you can. He said, I'm on my way to the airport, and I can stop up at your house.
And I guess the big payoff moment of the show is when Sammy Davis meets Archie and says goodbye, right?
Right. They had talked for a while. It was beautifully done. Sammy was great. But at the first reading, everything went very well. The script sounded terrific, and we were all very happy. But as the script ended and the cast was dismissed for coffee, for take a break, I kept sitting there thinking there's something wrong. And Lear came over and said, what's going on? I said, well, I think we have a good show. The script is good, but there's no finish. The finish that was written was that a neighbor wants to take a picture of Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy says, and Archie says, no pictures. And Sammy says, no, I want a picture with my friend Archie, whatever it was. And by all means, take the picture. I want to remember this occasion. And then he leaves. And I said to Norman, it's flat. I'd like to have something real physical that goes on. And I don't know what, and as I sat there, I started to grin. And Norman said, you got something? I said, maybe. I said, I think Sammy ought to kiss Archie on the cheek. And Norman said, you think, really? I said, yeah, it's worth a shot. I said, I think it's a wonderful finish. I think it'll work. Well, it worked, if I may say, brilliantly. In fact, the applause and the laughter was so long that we had to cut it down because you couldn't stay on it that long. The audience just went berserk.
We're speaking with John Rich. He's a veteran TV and movie director, and he has a new memoir called Warm Up the Snake. Let's hear some of Sammy Davis Jr.'s visit to the Bunker House.
You know, Sammy, them words I just heard you saying here, they reminded me of something that I always wanted to ask you.
Yes, I.
Yeah, now, you're being colored. Well, I know you had no choice in that. But whatever made you turn Jew?
I'm sorry, Mr. Davis. Sometimes my father says the wrong things.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But he's not a bad guy, Mr. Davis. I mean, like, he'd never burn a cross on your lawn.
No, but if he saw one burning, he's liable to toast a marshmallow on it.
One other question I had to ask you about All in the Family. You know, one of the sets that was used a lot was the dinner table, the four of them sitting around the dinner table.
Right.
And you see this a lot in movies and television where people are supposed to be eating, but they're not really eating. They don't really take bites. They push food around. You insisted that people ram food into their mouths. Why?
Well, because one of my deep complaints is exactly what you just said. I hate to see an eating scene where people sit down to a meal and they don't eat. They just push the peas around. And of course, there's a real reason for it, and it's because an actor doesn't want to get stuck with food in his or her mouth to deliver their lines. But I said, look, on the Bunker family, I said, when dinner is served, you folks should be ravenous, and we should really play it with real food. Eating carefully has to be choreographed. It is not a simple thing to do. You have to be able to figure out how much you can take, how much you can masticate, how much you can put on the side of your mouth to be able to deliver the lines. So I said, let's rehearse with food. So we got stew. The prop man brought in I think it was some canned stew. And Carol O'Connor said, I can't eat this stuff. I said, well, he said, you're right about the eating, but I can't eat this. I said, okay. I said, let's send out to Chasen's. It was a very famous restaurant in Hollywood. They made a stew that was made of Kobe beef, I think. It was very expensive, but it was terrific. And the family would sit down, and we would eat all this food. And I said, it has to be ravenous. You must, everybody fight for your, and eat a lot, which they did. Now, that's what gave it...
Well, why did that, you want them? Why did you want that? Wouldn't it have been just as effective to deliver the lines? No?
No, no, no. It's very funny because you got extra moments out of it that were terrific. Glaring, you know, somebody going for the same piece of meat, somebody going for the same roll or whatever, or Archie deliberately putting too much ketchup on something, but Edith looks at him reproachfully, and Archie puts more ketchup on. All has to be timed. Yeah, there was a moment I had between Carol and Meathead where they meet over a piece of something and glare at each other. But, there's an air of verisimilitude. Is that the word?
Right, like a real family, right.
It was a real family, yeah.
John Rich, you opened this book with describing a meeting with some young TV people where you're pitching yourself for a job, and they love you because you've done all this amazing stuff, and they kind of say, well, this is like talking to a legend. And then you realize that once you're a legend, maybe it's time to stop doing it and start writing it. I wanted you to reflect a little bit on how the business has changed. I mean, you write about this some in the book. Do you think you could direct television nowadays?
No. No. I could direct it if they left me alone. But they don't let you alone. I don't care who you are. You now have the assistance of a phalanx of writers. You have the assistance of a network. You have the assistance of a studio. You have people who are sponsors for the product. They all come down, and they all have an idea of what to do. And it's direction by committee. And, of course, it's like the old saw that a camel is a horse that has been designed by a committee.
Right, right.
And also, I believe in the privacy of the rehearsal. It's essential to me to let the actors be able to be foolish if they want to be in rehearsal, to find something deeper than the words themselves. You can't do that when there are people who are watching. You have to have an in-group. So I forbade anybody, to visit during the 3 days of private rehearsal. In that way, the actors could really find something to play. They could do physical things that they would never try in front of somebody else. The minute somebody walks into that room who is not of the in-group, they begin to perform. And the last thing I want on a rehearsal day is performance. I want investigation. Huh. And that's what they were able to do.
There was a moment you describe in the book where the child and some friends of studio executives came in. And very important people, you didn't care, you chased them out.
It was not studio executives, it was the network that I was on. It was ABC. one day I had my rule. I was working privately with my group. And I noticed a cadre of people suddenly standing at one end of the stage, of the studio. So I immediately called a break. I didn't want anything to be seen. And I looked at my assistant, Doug Smart, and I said, Doug, and I just nodded. He said, yeah, I know. And he went over to talk to these people to leave. And he came back, and they were still there. I said, what's going on? He said, it's Buffy Thermopolis. I said, oh, that's a great name. But what's Buffy Thermopolis? I said, I recognize the last name. I said, it could be Tony Thermopolis' daughter, who happened to be president of ABC. And he said, yeah, that's who it is, and she wants to watch you work. And I said, no, be very polite and tell her that this is a closed set today. She's welcome to come on any Monday or Tuesday, because then we have cameras and the actors are no longer investigating. They're really playing now, and it's almost a finished product. So be nice. So he went over, and they left. And he came back, and he said, boy, she was steaming. You're going to hear about this. I said, look, you know how we work. All right, half hour went by. The phone page on the set came over and said, Mr. Rich, there's a phone call for you from New York. Tony Thermopolis is calling, my president. I said, okay, I'll take the call. Now, I was conscious that everybody would hear my end of the conversation. So I launched into a rapid-fire delivery. I said, Tony, I'm so glad you called because I was going to call you. I don't know if you remember my two boys, Anthony and Robert. Anthony is now 12, Robert is 10, And we're going to be in New York in a couple of weeks, and they have both expressed great interest in seeing how a network executive conducts his business. They're very well-behaved boys, so do you mind if I bring them into your office? They'll stand quietly in a corner and watch you negotiate contracts. Will that be all right with you, Tony? Okay? What do you think? There was a long silence. I said, by the way, why'd you call me? He said, oh, just seeing how things are going. I said, thanks for the call. Bye.
Oh. Well, John Rich, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, I thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
John Rich spent more than 50 years in television. His new book is Warm Up the Snake, a Hollywood memoir.